Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here hosting this weekend's edition as Chad and I were both at the New Orleans Investment Conference this week. And well, we're recording this show early on in the week on Tuesday, right before I head out to New Orleans to get in front of a lot of resource companies, get an understanding or even more feeling on the overall sentiment in the resource sector, especially for the stocks. On this weekend show, I'm going to be focusing a lot on the resource stock, simply because, well, I have a couple guests that follow these stocks, are very active in the sector, and I know we're all wondering when the underlying resource stocks will play catch up to some of these just generally higher metals prices. I'm kicking off the show with Cam Curry, Senior Investment Advisor at Canaccord Genuity, Head of Curry Metals and Mining Group. Now, Cam, first big picture topic, and I don't want to spend too much time here because really feel like we've talked this to death over the last couple of years, but look, gold, as we're recording this, right at about that $2,000 level, but the stocks just seem to continue to lag. We've seen a little bit of a bounce in the last couple of weeks, but overall, I know a lot of investors in the space are saying, look, gold is at such a good level here, but the stocks aren't getting any value. Cam, what's your take on this big picture, this macro concept?
Well, again, Corey, thank you very much once again for having me. And that is one of the biggest perplexing situations in our equity space right now. And, you know, I've given numerous interviews on the topic of narrative economics. And in the Western world right now, there's just no narrative towards gold. I mean, gold's at $2,000 an ounce and no one's paying attention. Case in point, if you look at gold ETF holdings, in the last 9 months, gold ETF holdings have gone from 3,400 tons to 2,700 tons. So the Western world continually dribbles out gold in exchange for higher yielding instruments than that. Whereas gold's at $2,000 and you look at Eastern central banks, they keep on exchanging US dollars for gold. In fact, 2 weeks ago in Singapore, spot gold was in this 2000 range and the physical delivery was $90 over spot. So there's nobody really paying attention. So I think what's so key to monitor right now, and in fact, yesterday, the gold ETF holdings in the States was up by 20 tons, the first time we've seen that in a long time, in fact, 18 months. So the gold ETF flows are the key, in my view, right now, because once the gold ETF flows increase, the gold equity flows should get some attention. And with the dollar, you know, skirting at 106 on the index, the Dixie, and gold still at all-time highs, I think we're getting closer to that inflection point. And at that point, we should get some money flows because we still have redemptions in gold funds, believe it or not, despite gold at 2000.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing, hey, is that the dollar's been generally higher, rates are generally higher, and gold is doing very well, but it's just not filtering down into the stocks. You mentioned some of these higher yielding instruments seem to be the favor. Is that the biggest problem for these stocks, is that there is a bit of this risk off attitude? So investors just aren't going into equities broadly?
Well, that's one of it. But, you know, it's interesting. I do some of my best thinking at 2 o'clock in the morning. I was reflecting back on previous cycles. And I still remember back in the dot-com bubble of 2000 when I was telling everybody how stupid the valuations were, comparable to what was 2022. In 2000, you know, we had this correction in the dot-com bubble. But a lot of people forget that it got flushed out and then it had a 40% bounce. And everyone thought, okay, we're back on track with the tech stocks. Well, if you look what happened last November, we had that capitulation in the tech stocks. And since then, we've had this big rally in tech stocks. And a lot of people have clambered back into them because, again, muscle memory and thinking that, you know, they can make their money back. And so in 2002, we were buying the gold stocks when gold was at $350 an ounce. And nobody was paying attention similar to today because the money was chasing the sectors they had lost money for because they thought they were making their money back, which is what we've just gone through in the United States equity markets. So I think now we're starting to see that rollover in the U.S. equities. You take out the top seven companies out of the S&P, it's down 10% for the year. So gold's where it is, but no one's paying attention because they're still chasing the bounce in the tech stocks. So it was late 2002, early 2003, the U.S. dollar index started rolling over and gold went through 400. And that's when the attention came into the space. And that's when the gold stocks took off. So we have yield competition plus people chasing the sectors that they got decimated in 2 years ago because they think they can make their money back. So we have two combinations here that are keeping money flows or recognition of gold at 2000.
Now, what about the majors? A lot of people are looking at the majors saying they usually get moving first in an early on bull market. It does show bigger investors paying attention to the sector. To your point, clearly these bigger investors aren't paying attention because these majors, which should be generating some pretty decent profits, they're trading in wide ranges, kind of in the middle of these ranges. It's not very exciting charts.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing. The algos and that look for these momentum shifts and that. And let's face it. I mean, you look at Barrick at $22 or $21.50, whatever it is. Newmont's just digesting the Newcrest acquisition and they missed in their quarter. And, you know, you look at both those companies, which are the bellwethers in the indexes in the S&P index, Newmont being S&P and Barrick being the other in another index, that they're not performing. And, you know, they're flat production. Increasing costs. So it's gold price related. And so if they're not performing, the money flows aren't coming in. But if you look at some of the mid-tiers, they've been delivering. You look at Alamos, Eldorado, you know, Lundin Gold. I mean, you know, they're the 500,000 ounce producer growth stories. They're trading almost near their highs here. So there are some performances, but again, there's no money flows. And that's the problem.
Why are the mid-tiers doing so much better? Have they been able to control costs better? Are they more favorably looked upon? Make sense of that environment, please.
Well, costs, one. Assets, growth, two. Discipline is management is key. And there's very few of them. And, you know, I was talking to one in particular. I'm not going to mention the name, but they were talking about how two ETF indexes have come into the stocks. And so you have these indexes that flow into these things. And again, that's such a key component to today's equity markets, whether it's tech, life science, is that ETF flows. And as I said, we've had gold ETFs going down for the last 9 months from 3,400 tons to 2,700 tons. And so naturally, the gold equity ETFs are following suit. So that has to shift. And yesterday's move of 20 tons to the upside was the first time we've seen that type of move in 18 months. So we'll see how that momentum changes.
Yeah, it's generally been lower volume in these ETFs as well, especially GDX, GDXJ. The volume has been very, very weak. Do we need to be looking at these mid-tiers then to maybe spark some M&A, to maybe free up some capital for investors in some of the smaller companies? Because quite frankly, I think some of these investors are just stuck in some of these smaller stocks.
Oh, and you know, again, you know, I'm cornerstone in five different companies that are either just started production or producing 200,000 to 300,000 ounce production. But they're, you know, the challenge is they're single asset companies and we have no ETF flows into the space. And so you look at some of these companies, they're trading at 0.2 times NAV. Whereas you look at the mid-tiers, they're trading at 0.8 times NAV. So you've got these situations where the money flows are going into the tier ones right now. There's no money flows coming to the next level. So, you know, there should be some M&A taking place, but you talk to some of the tier ones and they go, well, we can't find assets that are operating the low cost profiles that our existing assets are. So why would we compromise our profits and buy something of lesser quality? So there's elements to that. But reality is that there's a scarcity of assets. I mean, that's the biggest thing. And that's what, you know, in the last cycle, I was involved with eight companies that were taken over. That's my theme this time too, because there's been no real exploration development, no new assets coming out of the pipeline, and they're very few and far between. And at some point here, there will be some tension in the boardrooms to step up M&A. And quite honestly, I don't want that to start now because these companies we're involved with are just too cheap and they could be picked off quite easily here. And you know, I think we need some tension in the boardroom before we get some good premiums.
Well, and that's why I think a lot of people are looking at the mid-tiers because they're saying, well, at least they can use their stocks that have performed well rather than the majors, the big boys, where, again, their stocks haven't done much. You brought up tier one companies, a lot of conversation about tier one assets. And to your point that there just aren't that many tier one assets out there, what separates some of the best quality assets in your eyes that it sounds like you work with or you work closely beside?
Well, tier one assets usually find out after or down the line, because they evolve into tier one assets. Because as you know, the exploration game is, starts off on grassroots. And I don't play grassroots per se. I wait for things to present themselves and get in when I start recognizing the potential of a tier one asset. And, you know, they're very rare. I mean, people can claim to have tier one assets, but in today's world, the geopolitical risks are getting greater, permitting risks, environmental risks, narrative risks, all these risks are greater in today's environment. So you can be so right, and then political change can take place and it can go so wrong. You know, you look what's happening right now in Panama. I mean, First Quantum has just lost, $14 a share because of what's going on with the mining law there. And now it's going to go to election in May. It's going to be very noisy for a long period of time. We've been involved with a number of jurisdictions. I mean, Peru flipped upside down when Castillo got elected. And you can be a tier one asset, but then it's stuck in a geopolitical shift. And all of a sudden, that's no longer a tier one asset. So that's why it's important to have a basket of companies. And that's why, companies that, like mid-tiers, have 3, 4, 5 assets. They have diversification. Whereas if you're a single asset, like in West Africa, the noise in Niger, we got hit on a couple of our names there too, but it's business as usual. But the narrative depicts the overthrow of democracy, whereas gold mining is the number one industry in a lot of West African countries, and the governments are your partners.
Well, you want them to be your partners, but yeah, you are right. We've seen a number of issues jurisdictionally wise, especially in South America, but we'll maybe circle around to that in terms of the assets that you're focused on then. Look, you're not looking grassroots. What stage do you like to get into a company or really filter into an asset when it comes to either economic studies, certain sizes of resource? What kind of metrics can you give us here?
I mean, that's a very good question, because I probably have 8 companies on my radar that I really, really like. I really like management, really like the assets, but they're in that development, quiet, permitting stage per se. And so they're ticking the boxes. And so they're in that dead zone, so to speak. Despite the assets being great assets, I'll revisit them later on. So typically, I like to look at assets that are unlocking significant exploration upside. So they may have a certain size asset, but all of a sudden there's a shift in the resource interpretation that changes it to a much greater asset. I love those type of stories. I was very, very fortunate to recognize the Filo opportunity 3 years ago when they put the hole into the sulfides and in the Fukunga district, and the rest is history on that. But the other side is you see these companies that are delivering on the performance of their assets. We have one company in particular that has gone from 80,000 ounce production to 275,000 ounce production, had $70 million in debt. Now they've got $100 million US in the bank, and they're firing all pistons, and they're very undervalued. So, but you're seeing the execution, and you just keep on buying, sticking away, because eventually when the money flows come in, they're going to go to those type of companies.
Well, and it's the money flows that come in on the investment front, but then also financing risk. Do you prefer companies that are in production right now with a growth profile over those companies that are in construction in the kind of that slow period, but also looking to or needing to raise money to complete the build?
Well, companies under construction going towards production. Yeah, I've got a couple in my portfolio, and there's always the thoughts of are they funded through to production, or are they underfunded and that. And in a positive gold environment, the stocks are going to perform, and that won't be an issue. But in this vacuum we've been in for the last 2 months, when gold price slapped down $200 and then it bounced back, a lot of these stocks got taken down thinking they had to do equity raises. And so let's face it, there's no money flows coming into the space. So if you have to raise capital, you're at the whim of the market. And for the juniors, I mean, that's a very scary place to be right now, because we need some serious money flows to come into the space before we really start getting anybody going into the junior market. For them to keep on advancing their assets or even survive in this environment, it's tough. And so there's going to be some great opportunities, but you have to wait for that shift, right?
What signals to you that shift then? Is it simply just money flows into the ETFs, an increase in volume, a bit more momentum to the upside?
Absolutely. And, I mentioned narrative economics, and a lot of stuff I've been talking about is starting to take place in the U.S. economy, and the discussion of debt is becoming much more topical. Even looking at the Fed balance sheet, that's another topic that's coming in. And so, you know, quite honestly, it's this U.S. dollar. U.S. dollar starts rolling over here. That's when I think the shift of psychology is going to really start taking place. We had the Dixie breakdown below 100 and gold was at 2000. The stock started reacting like in 2003. Between 2003 and 2007, the Dixie dropped from, you know, 100 down to 74. And we had a very significant rally in gold and gold equities. And I think we're on the cusp of that, you know, because again, you know, when the U.S. dollar does roll over, where is money going to go? And Eastern central banks continue to buy gold. What most people don't understand, Corey, is that the three largest reserve currencies in the world are the U.S. dollar, the euro, and gold. Euroland, in my view, has already gone into recession. I think the U.S. is just slipping into recession. So the question is, you know, what currency do you want to add to your portfolio looking down on this planet? And gold is the only reserve currency that has no political attachment, no debt obligation, and no printing press. But the Western investor isn't aware of that. They aren't even thinking that. And that's the opportunity.
Well, the gold price has done pretty well, right? And so is the dollar, though. So to your point, maybe watch for that dollar rollover. What about some other metals? We've talked a lot about gold here, but there is, I think, more interest still in critical minerals. Copper, I still read a lot of articles on copper, but doesn't seem to still have that same investment demand. What are you seeing in terms of other metals and interest in those?
Well, rare earths, you know, again, we all know about the problems going forward and supply chains and, you know, the challenges between U.S.-China relations and that. And so rare earths are a necessity, but they're very rare. And trying to find projects, you know, that that you can invest in, that's a very, very challenging situation. Lithium, the lithium story, you know, it got very frothy. Now it's coming back into a valuation matrix where you start sharpening your pencils. But you're also seeing, like you saw Ford the other day, they've cut their EV by $12 billion. Mercedes came out and said they're selling their cars for less than what they cost to make them. So this push towards electrification may be more challenging cost-wise, and it may not happen as quick as people may think in our world, which may put, you know, some question into the lithium stories. Copper, I love copper. I think copper long-term is significant. The thing about copper right now is caught up in the narrative of, you know, copper is a PhD of economics. And so if we have a global slowdown, which I think we are entering into or have been in for a period of time, copper prices can suffer. What's different with copper this time, though, is the supply side. There's just no new copper mines coming down the pipeline. And the existing mines are very long in their tooth, and they're mining grades at 0.25% copper opposed to 0.75%. And they're in deep pits down in Chile and Peru. And so supply is a huge problem coming forward. There's no CapEx being spent on new projects. There's sustaining CapEx being spent. But, you know, the big new projects required for supply side just aren't going into production. And on the demand side, well, we know the electrification is going to continue. And so copper, we're setting up for a phenomenal buy in the copper stocks. I just don't know when.
Yeah, I don't think anybody does, because a lot of people were thinking this year would be a good year for copper. But there is also that potential recession headwind, too. What about silver? We've talked a lot, again, about gold and how well gold's doing. Silver is done okay, but as we're recording this, right around $23, kind of trading within this range. Nowhere near those all-time highs. What do you see in silver?
Well, again, it's interesting. Gold at 2,000, silver at 23. I would think silver would be a lot higher just from the investment demand. But again, we just don't have that investment demand kick in like as of yet. What's unique to silver, though, is, again, the application in the electrification of the world and digital and medical, too. I mean, the amount of silver used in hospitals and clinics and that is very significant. And so it's kind of a misunderstood investment. What I'm also thinking about silver is that supply side coming forward is going to be a real challenge, because silver is a byproduct in a lot of mines. And there's just no money being spent on developing these projects. And so supply side on silver is going to be a problem moving forward. And so, you know, again, going back to whether it's copper, silver, gold, there's just no new projects coming on the pipeline of material size. They're going to shift supply.
Well, that brings up a whole other point where it seems like a lot of companies have been focused on bringing online smaller production, whether it's because they got stuck and quite frankly had to build the mine, or they say, look, at least we can make money with this small operation and fund some of our exploration. How do you feel about that corporate strategy, but then also that way of, I guess, supplying the market?
Well, it's not going to make a difference in supply because they're so small. But that strategy, I think, is I don't look at assets unless they're 125, 150,000 ounce plus production profiles with, 15-year mine lives. You've got to have something that's meaningful. If you're a 50,000 ounce producer, the hoops you have to go through to get to that, to put that into production, and usually they're like a 10-year mine life, and you may be able to increase the mine life. There's a lot of risks, and this industry is tough enough as it is. When you do actually, get involved with an asset, you want something that's going to pay dividends for a long period of time.
So I guess final question then, Cam, as much as we've talked about, again, kind of the lack of investment interest in these stocks, you've outlined that you do work with around 8 companies that it sounds like you're very loyal to. What about the investor that's sitting on the sideline with a little bit of cash or a lot of cash saying, I want to get positions in here, but should I take a shotgun approach, buy a lot of these undervalued companies and stocks, or do I need to focus on just a select few that seem like they're, I guess, closer to production or have a more established asset?
Well, by the sound of your question to the listener, they're trying to do it themselves. And this industry is extremely difficult to navigate yourself, because you can read all you want, but unless you understand the assets, the management, the jurisdictions, where the asset is in its development cycle, there's a lot of things to think about. So, our approach is a basket approach. And, I've got, depends on your risk profile. I've got people that have seniors, mid-tiers, developers. And so you have to approach it on a portfolio basis. You can buy the ETFs, but ETFs, in my view, are not the efficient way of buying a sector, because when you buy an ETF, the money sprays into all the companies in that ETF. A lot of times companies get into these ETFs that, have fatal flaws, but because they have market caps or promotes, they get into those index. And so you're buying those companies. You'd be better off, buying a basket of select companies designed for you to meet your investment needs.
All right, Cam, great chatting with you. Thank you very much for sharing some of your insights. I know we can't talk too specifically about companies, but you have given us some tips in terms of what you are looking for, some of the companies that you are working with, and some of the ones it sounds like that you're largely avoiding. So I really appreciate your time here, Cam. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And yeah, if you want to follow along with Cam, check out Curry Metals and Mining Group. That's where Cam runs his operations. Thanks for your time, Cam. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Corey.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.